We might kick off because we have been given really strict time instructions. So good morning, everyone. My name is Vicky Mullen. I'm a senior consultant with Finity Consulting, and I am delighted to chair this session this morning, Making Sense of the Tsunami, a Stocktake of Outcomes and Supports in the Disability Sector. I'd just like to kick off. This personally is a particularly interesting presentation to me. I well remember, some of you are probably a bit too young, but Bill Shorten's seminal speech to the National Press Club in 2009, which is probably one of the better political speeches I've ever read, which is all about the extent of disability across the Australian community. And it kind of set the wheels in motion for the whole discussion around setting up the NDIS. And I remember at the time many people actually saying that the NDIS will never happen. But here we are 16 years later, and how much has happened. So really pleased to be able to introduce Dr. Hugh Miller and Laura Dixie to you in a second, but just wanted to quickly call out this presentation canvasses some really big developments in recent years, particularly the inception of Australia's Disability Strategy 2021 to 2031, the extensive work done by the Disability Royal Commission, for which the final report was released in September 2023, the NDIS review, for which the final report was published also in 2023, and not last or least, the extensive work being done on the National Disability Data Asset, which, as many of you would know, is bringing together really critical disability data from right across Australia, from Commonwealth, state and territory governments, to try and identify where there are gaps for the disability community in Australia. So with that background, oh, and I also just wanted to quickly call out, many of you would know John Walsh, who sadly left us about a year ago. I always tell the story that John was one of the first actuaries that I ever met, and when he was actually promoting the concept of lifetime care for New South Wales CTP, and he was then the pioneer of the NDIS system. So I just wanted to acknowledge John. And there's a wonderful profile of John on the Actuaries Institute website. So I'd like to introduce Dr. Hugh Miller. Hugh Miller is a principal at Taylor Fry. For the past 10 years, he has been applying actuarial techniques to social sector problems spanning welfare, employment, housing, disability and health. He has led major pieces of work for the Disability Royal Commission and the NDIS Review, and was the 2021 Actuary of the Year. Laura Dixie, is an experienced actuary and a director at Taylor Fry Consulting. She works in Taylor Fry's government practice using quantitative analysis applied to a range of data sets to understand how people interact with services in the health, disability and social sectors. So I'd like to welcome and thank Hugh and Laura to step you through their presentation. Thank you.
Thank you so much for the introduction. Thank you all for coming along too. Really, really appreciate that. So when we were thinking about what we'd like to present on, we've actually done quite a few quite interesting jobs in the space of disability. So it was a case of trying to sort of pick one and sort of focus on that. And as we sort of thought about it, it was getting hard because there are so many things going on in the disability sector. And so the motivation was actually just to zoom out and actually say, well, just acknowledge there is a lot going on, try and give a little bit of an overview. It'll obviously be fairly sort of coloured by our experiences and the things that we sort of worked on and the data that sits behind all that. But really just sort of dealing with this sort of topic of sort of what's happened in the disability sector over the past few years, what's likely to happen in the future. So hopefully a good introduction. The talk will be successful if it motivates you to go out and sort of have a look at some of these other reports, because it is ultimately going to be relatively high level. Wonderful welcome to country this morning. I hope you are there to see that. So in terms of what we're going to talk about today, I'll give a very selective timeline to kick off, and then Laura will talk through disability in Australia, sort of an overview of the population and what we can say, and then she'll actually look at some of those reports that Vicky mentioned and some of the key takeaways from that, and then I'll pop up again after that to talk about some of the intersections and inequalities we can see in the disability space. So to jump right in then, this is a very selective timeline. So it starts at 2008. The path for improved rights and supports for people with disability has been a very, very long-running process. And so before 2008, a lot of things did happen. A couple of the big things that did happen legislatively was the Disability Service Act, as well as the Disability Discrimination Act, and that sort of really did pave the way for a lot of development that happened in the 80s and 90s. But our timeline here starts in 2008, where Australia officially signed on to the Convention of Rights for People with Disability in 2008, and so that was under Kevin Rudd. Australia originally did not sign the convention when it came out, so sort of under the former government, decided that the obligations were actually too much to commit to because they are quite extensive in terms of the aspirational rights of people with disability to fully participate in society and all the aspects such as housing and education and justice and health and so forth. So if you ever do read that, that they're actually quite a comprehensive set of rights that Australia's committed to. Not long after that, the government released the report Shutout, still available on the Department of Social Services website. And that really was actually a bit of a stock take in terms of what life was like for people with disability in Australia. And as the title may suggest to you, the answer was they were actually excluded from a lot of society. So people with disability, particularly in, say, group home environments, while they were not as bad as some of the institutions that preceded them, they really struggled to participate in society and all the types of things that a lot of other people would take for granted. And so that report, plus signing on to the CRPD, really sort of snowballed a lot of activity in the policy space for disability. And that culminated in the NDIS, which was legislated and trial sites started in 2013, and then gradually was rolled out. And so it took a full 5 or 6 years to roll that out fully. And now we've had that running up and running fully for about 5 or 6 years as well. Since that time, though, there's been a lot of other things that have changed. Australia released a new disability strategy, again, with sort of some quite aspirational targets and things to track. The Disability Royal Commission was a long-running, sort of 2 or 3 years, to collect a lot of evidence around what's not going well in the disability space and focusing on issues of maltreatment. And then the NDIS review was commissioned in 2023, and that was quite a landmark report in terms of identifying what was going well and not well in the scheme. Some legislative changes off the back of that last year, a lot of other changes now happening because of those things. And so we've drawn it as a twisty line because overall things have been getting better, I think, in terms of supports available for people with disability, but it's not completely linear. And I guess that's sort of where we are right now. So I might hand over to Laura, and I'll see you again in a sec.
Cool. Thanks, Hugh. So firstly, what we wanted to do is just give you a bit of an overview of the population with disability in Australia and what that looks like. So the first thing we want to look at is, well, how many people have disability in Australia? And we jump to the ESTAC, which is the Survey of Disability, Ageing and Caring, and that tells us about 1 in 5 people have a disability. So it's quite a large population. But when you look at disability, it's really important to consider age trends. A lot of disability is tied to ageing. So you can see on this chart on the right, it's the rate of disability by age band. And so ignore the colours for now. You can just look at that trend increasing from about 5% for the youngest age groups right through to 95% at our oldest age groups. And so what that adds up to is that of people with disability in Australia, you can think about half being over age 65 and half being under age 65. The other things we typically look at are what types of conditions or impairments do people have, and we often jump to physical disability. That is the most common, 75%, but actually mental and behavioural disorders are also very large, making up the main condition for about 1/4 of people with disability. The final kind of dimension that's very commonly looked at is the level of disability or the impairment level, and that's the colours on this chart. So looking at the blue, the dark blue and light blue, that's people with severe or profound disability. Overall, that's about 25%, but you can see that rate is increasing with age as well. About another 25% have a more mild or moderate disability. And then half of people with disability that's less severe, but it is impacting their ability to participate in work or education. So we jumped in and started using the SDAC, or the Survey of Disability, Ageing and Carers. But it's important to realise there are a few different definitions of disability, and that's really important when you start thinking about policy or working with different data sets. The population you're talking about actually changes quite a lot. So the SDAC is sort of the gold standard if you're reporting on disability prevalence, and that's our 20%. If we look at ABS census, that restricts the population down to people who actually need assistance with a core activity. And so this chart on the right is showing the rate under the different definitions by age. So the blue lines is the SDAC. That's the same chart we had on the previous slide, but I've cut the y-axis off just so you can see. And so the pink lines are census there. And so you can see census is restricting it down to a more severe disability subset, but it's covering all the ages. Disability support pension is another common population with disability. It ties into work capacity and age. And you can see those are the grey lines, so a working age population with an older skew. The final one is NDIS participants, so that's the yellow. And this is quite a high level of impairment with a lifetime support need, and it's got a very young age skew, you can see there. So we'll jump back to the SDAC definition now, but it's just important to keep in mind that there are sort of different subgroups within the population of disability. So the latest SDAC results relate to 2022, but they actually just were released last year. And they showed a remarkable trend. So the total rate of disability had popped up from 18% to 21%. And you can see on the chart there at the top that it just reverses the trend of successive years. And that actually, while we've got an ageing population and disability is tied to ageing, our age standardised rate shows the exact same trend. So this isn't just an ageing population. And then the chart on the bottom there is showing the relative increase between 2018 and 22. So a value of 1 means the rate hasn't changed, and our x-axis is age group. So what we see is for younger people up to about age 35, the rate has increased about 1.5 times. It's about 1.2 for sort of those later working age years, and then for the oldest age groups, the rate's basically unchanged. And you see these increases across different definitions, different subsets by impairment level. It's quite fascinating. When we think about why this is happening, it's actually really hard to untangle whether there's a higher level of awareness, which might mean people are sort of self-identifying as someone with disability more commonly, versus higher prevalence, so actual rates of diagnosis. And interestingly, this is seen across numerous countries, so UK, Canada, and USA are some examples. They all see increasing rates of disability, and particularly increasing rates of autism among children, which is very present in Australia as well. So that chart on the top there is showing the rate of autism. The colouring is successive years of the SDAC, and it's age by age band on the x-axis. So there's an interesting age curve there, but the main thing is we can see year on year that rate is just increasing and increasing. The consensus kind of globally is that this reflects both higher awareness, so parents recognising symptoms in their children, clinicians being more aware, but also expanding assessment boundaries. So someone with a relatively low level of impairment who might not have previously received a diagnosis will now receive a diagnosis. And overall autism rates are still relatively low, about 1% of the population, but the growth is large. And in Australia, it ties into the NDIS, so it's a really important trend to keep an eye on. The chart on the bottom there is the breakdown of NDIS participants by whether that main diagnosis is related to autism versus not. So the grey is something else, the blue is autism, the other colours are developmental delays, which typically precede an autism diagnosis in children. So you can see it's a really significant factor. In fact, about half of all participants have a diagnosis relating to autism. And for young kids who, because it's a lifetime scheme, have very large costs associated with them, the rate is up to 90%. So it's a really significant factor in the NDIS. Which sort of brings us to some key takeaways from 3 recent milestone publications. So as she said, Hugh said, we don't have a huge amount of time. I just want to touch on these 3 briefly. The sector is in a period of change, hopefully improvement, and these are the ones that are really driving that. or suggesting what needs to change. So the Royal Commission, a huge body of work, 222 recommendations, which speaks to the level of evidence found of maltreatment of people with disability. One piece of work that Taylor Fry did that speaks to the complexity as well as the extent of the issues is an economic costing associated with maltreatment of people with disability. And so that broke this maltreatment down into two different areas, so interpersonal violence, abuse, neglect, as well as systemic failures in the systems. The total annual cost of maltreatment of people with disability, $46 billion, so absolutely huge. And this reflects both we've got quite a large population with disability, so that 20%, really high rates of maltreatment. So they found 60% of people with disability will experience that interpersonal maltreatment in their lifetime. But actually, the larger component, so $28 billion of that $46 billion annual cost, is systemic issues. And so that sort of speaks to the ability of changes in policy to hope improve things. In terms of where these costs or poor outcomes are seen, health and well-being is the largest, but also spanning employment, economic, housing, as well as the justice system. So, as I said, 222 recommendations. This is just trying to give you a bit of a flavour for them. There was a real focus coming out of the Disability Royal Commission on human rights, so new laws and statutory bodies to try and embed that. A real focus on increasing mainstream inclusion of people with disability, so phasing out special schools in the education sector, phasing out segregated employment. And some of these Hugh will touch on a bit more deeply with examples. The other key one there is intersections. So First Nations people and women where disadvantage tends to compound, and there are further issues. I think that's all I want to say. The next topic I wanted to cover briefly is the NDIS review. So it started in the context of, I mean, you probably all know, massive growth in costs. Annual spending is now over $40 billion a year. It's second only to the age pension. And the growth was sort of 14% per annum. The latest figures just came out recently and they're a bit lower, but it's still growing. The other key concern was it being an oasis in the desert. So within the scheme, there was support for people, but outside of the scheme, state-run services have been wound back and there was very little support for people who weren't actually getting into the NDIS. So again, huge body of work, came up with 26 recommendations, I think. The one piece of work Taylor Fry did was estimating the cost and benefit associated with the scheme. So the results are there, net costs of $16 billion versus benefits of $8 billion. But you do need to keep in mind that not all benefits are measurable. And also it's not uncommon for social policy programs to have greater costs than benefits. There are ethical concerns, there are human rights concerns. But the one thing I really wanted to pull out from that report is this chart here, because I think it explains a lot about the context of the review as well as some of the recommendations coming out of it. So it's quite a complicated chart, but bear with me. Across the x-axis, we've got disability groups, so that's acquired brain injury, we've got autism, cerebral palsy, carrying on. The A, B, C, D categories are level of impairment from lowest to most severe. And we can ignore the red bars, which are just gross spending, and focus on the blue dots and the lines. The x-axis is what proportion of NDI spending was on this group was similarly covered by legacy schemes before the NDIS. So what we see, first of all, is that axis only runs up to 80%. So across all disability groups and across all the severity levels, the spending on the cohorts is higher under the NDIS. So support has increased for people inside the scheme. But also across each of those disability groups, the lines are trending up. And so what's that saying is that increase in funding has been bigger for the lower level of impairment groups. But again, it's only for people in the scheme. And then outside of the scheme, services have been wound back. So that kind of ties into one of the key recommendations coming out of the NDIS review and one which is already seeing some action. So that's the introduction of foundational supports. So this is sort of the vision for foundational supports. There'll be new services. They will be run by state and territory governments, so quite a big development. And this vision is taken from the report. Essentially, we've got NDIS participants up the top there on the right. They haven't changed. Currently, we've got a support gap, which is going to be filled by the purple foundational supports. And down the bottom, we've got mainstream services, which need to be more inclusive. So that's why they sort of shift up in the vision. Foundational supports are going to provide earlier intervention to people outside of the scheme. So filling that gap, both targeted, which will be a bit more intensive, a bit more one-on-one, and more general supports. And the idea is these will be early supports, particularly for children with developmental concerns. The idea intervening early, improving longer-term outcomes, and reducing that longer-term reliance on the scheme. Like I said, 26 recommendations and a sort of a 5-year transition period. These are some of the other key themes coming out of those recommendations. So broader supports and access, a fairer and more consistent pathways. So it will be quite interesting to watch here because there is going to be a focus on eligibility being based on impairment level and functional need rather than diagnosis, including removing at the moment there are current diagnoses that almost get you straight into the scheme, which are going to be removed. Budgets being set at the whole of person level to provide a sort of a more holistic and more consistent budgeting rather than line by line by support need. As well as an evidence committee to provide some guidance on what is reasonable and necessary supports for disability, to get a more consistent view there. And the other one there is improving mainstream access and inclusion, which ties in very closely to the Disability Royal Commission themes coming out of that. It's time. Some other key themes are sort of listed along the bottom there. They're fairly self-explanatory. Navigation supports are quite interesting. So for people both inside and out the scheme, outside of the NDIS, these will aim to help them navigate services. So inside the NDIS, helping people use their budget well. Outside of the NDIS, connecting people to services, making sure they're getting those right supports nice and early. The final topic to touch on is the Australian Disability Strategy. So this actually preceded both of the reports, but it had a recent review in 2024, and that sort of saw fairly muted progress, and even split across improvements, deterioration, and no change. It does have a nice accountability mechanism where there is a outcomes framework and there is annual public reporting against that outcomes framework. There's a few challenges in that we've talked about. We've got this expanding population with disability, which you probably want to, coming into the denominator with rates, makes untangling change a little bit challenging, but it does provide a broad way to track change. 85 indicators, so it's big. And one thing I really like to see is that a lot of these, there was no data. And to their credit, they've gone out and there's a new survey now measuring community attitudes that was identified as a needed data source and is now being filled in and reported on. So I'll pass back to Hugh now, and he can cover off some of the issues in a bit more detail.
Thanks so much. So I'm going to talk a little bit now about disability and inequality. So sort of, again, sort of taking that sort of broad sort of view, a natural place to start is thinking about sort of how income inequality affects people with disability. So while there has been a lot of progress in terms of support with people with disability, there still remain quite large gaps, and income is one area where you can see that gap. So the chart on the top right basically shows the income over the life course as people age. The purple line at the top is for the general population, and then there are two sort of definitions of disability for the other two lines. And you can see that basically those sort of average lines never really sort of peak much above 30,000. And you see very large income gaps across the whole time course. And interestingly, you see those gaps for basically all groups of disability. So even for groups where people have a disability or health condition that doesn't impact their ability to work, you can still see those gaps. That income gap comes from a triple whammy. It is lower rates of employment, lower hours worked for people who are employed, and then lower wages per hour for those who are employed as well. And so at each stage of that chain, you sort of see issues coming through. And then you, of course, sort of see that in the income distributions as well. So the figures on the bottom right there are basically the proportion of people with disability across the five sort of income quintiles in Australia. So if it was evenly distributed, you'd expect 20% in each group. You can see that two-fifths of that disability population sort of sits within that bottom income quintile, so they're twice as represented, and equally they're half as likely to be in those top two income quintiles. So that gives a sense of that inequality. So you would expect some income gaps potentially because people's ability to work is impacted in many cases. But there is good evidence that a lot of this is systemic and maltreatment and discrimination ultimately. So there are quite big problems, and that was one of the things that we tried to estimate in the Disability Royal Commission. But of course, inequality is broader than just income. And so Laura and I did a report for the Institute a year or so ago, which was sort of trying to take that broad picture. Give it a Google if you're interested. The chart on the figure on the right, it's probably a bit hard for you to squint at, but actually it goes through a whole bunch of domains and looks at sort of where outcomes are sitting for a lot of people. And so you can see some those gaps in employment, so an 8 percentage point gap for employment, but interestingly a 12 percentage point gap for underemployment. So underemployment is actually quite a huge issue for people with disability. But looking at other domains as well, you can see much lower rates of housing ownership, 14 percentage point gap there. And that has huge implications as people age and retire, because owning a home or not is one of the biggest predictors of poverty in old age. Twice the rate of psychological distress is quite interesting, and it does actually show that there are sort of health needs for people with disability, often far beyond their sort of what is needed to support their actual disability. But even some of the social indicators are quite striking, and so being six times more likely to be a victim of violent crime comes through in those statistics, and I think just that's sort of blatantly just quite shocking. And it shows that we do have quite big outcome gaps across a broad range of domains, and so that's quite a useful sort of way of getting a bit of a feel for that. And that leads us into sort of the final topic I wanted to touch through relatively quickly, which is actually saying that a lot of the policy action and development for people with disability will actually be in the intersections. And so I wanted to just sort of touch on some interesting topics across some of those intersections. So it might actually be the Department of Employment or the Department of Education or the Department of Health actually making a lot of these reforms rather than just the NDIS and foundational supports. So, for example, education. State and territory governments have responsibility for offering supports to kids with disability in schools. And it's quite a large population. So the NCCD is a national collection, and that has estimated that the number of people who need support has gone from about 18% to 25% over a few years. Laura and I did a paper which had the figure on the top right, which looked at kids in their first year of school using AECD data, and it found that fully 33% of that population had some sort of need or development difficulty, or were recommended by their teachers for further assessment. We also experimented with square Venn diagrams. I don't know if they're a success, but it's always good to experiment. Interestingly, the public sector tends to bear a larger burden, so the number of kids with disabilities is higher in the public system until you hit the HSC Year 12 exams, where all of a sudden provisions for private schools seem to be higher. Which is interesting. And there was quite an interesting tension in the Disability Royal Commission around the role of special education, because in one sense, a lot of parents and kids quite enjoy their special schools. In another sense, that's obviously a bit of a segregation sort of activity where kids with disability are then separated from mainstream schooling. And so the commissioners were actually split on a recommendation to phase out special schools. In terms of disability and justice, this is one area where the data is not very good. So actually saying how many people in prison have disability, we don't really know. It could be 25%. It could be 50%. There are a couple of estimates there that come from different sources. In any rate, it's probably about five times the rate of the general population. So it says that sort of people with disability in prison is a significant thing. And a lot of that can actually be tied back to systemic disadvantage. So when you look at people with disability who are in prison, a lot of them have been interacting with the child protection system, other homelessness systems and so forth in their past. So there's sort of a story of disadvantage there. A lot of the policy reform will be about sort of good outcomes for people while they're in prison or while they're leaving prison. There's a particular focus on the forensic justice system. So that's what's happened when you plead not guilty by virtue of not being mentally fit to stand trial. And the Royal Commission found that a lot of outcomes for people in those circumstances were still not very good. Like they effectively still went to prison, had to serve a term, and had less control about when they got released. There's also been some look at the guardianship arrangements in Australia, which is basically when the government takes control of your decision-making on your behalf and how you run your assets. And there was a good ABC coverage there. Thanks so much. Disability and health is another one where the intersections are quite large and quite profound. We've moved to more of a social and rights-based model of disability these days, which means we tend to separate disability support needs and health needs, but it's worth recognising health needs for people with disability are far greater on average than the general population, partly because of sort of the rate of need, but also that those sort of needs can be more complex and more costly sometimes to deliver. Lots of things I could say. One thing we found in our Royal Commission work is that there's a clear social gradient effect here where people with disability tend to have higher rates of sort of risky behaviours or other conditions that increase the risks of poor health. So you can see, for instance, people aged 18 to 64 have a 12 percentage point gap in terms of their smoking rate, so much more likely to smoke, much more likely to have poor diet or have obesity, and that obviously sort of complicates things. And one other issue flagged in the review was psychosocial disability, which are people with sort of ongoing, often permanent sort of mental health needs. And that really is a gap because it straddles the two systems. And there's sort of quite a large population of people who are not eligible for the NDIS, who effectively lost some of their supports with the rollout of the scheme. Talking about housing and homelessness, the rate of homelessness for people with disabilities is probably about five times the general population. Again, data's not very good. There's also quite a lot of demand for people with disability for social housing. And so, for instance, statistics, again, not very good, but maybe sort of somewhere between 40 to 60 to 70% of people in social housing in Australia have a disability based on sort of their primary income source. There's a little bit of good news in the housing and homelessness. One is that government has had a clear policy to get young people in residential aged care out. So these are people basically originally had nowhere else to go, so were sort of put into aged care homes. The NDIS has been very effective about moving these people out into independent living. And you can see that chart on the right-hand side there, where the total number of people under 65 in aged care homes has fallen from about 6,000 down to about 1,000. Over not that long a period. Another thing that's quite interesting is that the NDIS has a social housing system in disguise. I don't think they like characterising it as that, but the specialist disability accommodation is actually subsidised housing that can be attached to people's plans, and they're actually building and adding quite a lot of housing stock off the back of that. So for a country where we've actually underfunded social housing for quite a few years, that's quite an interesting development, and it probably adds another 60% to the growth of social housing if you squint and pretend that's part of that stock. Whether it feeds into the sustainability challenges of the scheme is a separate question, I guess. And the last thing I wanted to talk about briefly was disability and employment. And so we know there are some significant gaps. I think what surprises some people is that there's actually about 20,000 people with disability in Australia who work in sheltered environments, so sometimes called Australian Disability Enterprises. On average, they receive about $7.50 an hour. The minimum wage for these people, it's about $3 an hour. And so these are sort of potentially exploitative, was the Disability Royal Commission's finding. But they're also complex, because if you shut them down overnight, people would be worse off in terms of absolute income. And actually, a lot of people with disability appreciate the chance to be have somewhere to go, have a community, and have a job that's useful. But there are some structural challenges around the sector already. So there are some quite large mandated increases in the minimum wages there. And one consequence of that is that a lot of these ADEs will actually not be financially viable in the near term. And so managing that process well, I think, is a challenge. There are other things going on in the space. So, again, we've done some work with White Box Enterprises. They're running sort of social enterprises to focus on employment outcomes for people with disability. Quite good results. The Disability Employment Service is a $1 billion government scheme that aims to help people find jobs. Again, that's being reformed this year, so it'll be interesting to see where that goes. So a couple of final comments about the future, and then we'll have a little bit of time for questions. Obviously, the number of people with disability will continue to change over time, probably increase, and some of those sort of rates and changes that, that Laura was talking about will be quite interesting as time goes by. In terms of reform to the disability sector, that rollout of foundational supports will be big, ultimately, and whether and how that feeds into NDIS sustainability will be interesting as well. And there will be a lot of other reforms that come off the back of that, as well as the recommendations from the Royal Commission. And hopefully you've got a bit of a flavour through that talk about intersections. In terms of things that interest actuaries a little bit more, so Vicky mentioned the National Disability Data Asset, which when it sort of reached fruition, will cover a huge range of data sets, give a better view on some of those things where data is poor, which will be fantastic. There's also a need to collect better disability information in a whole bunch of services. So we're looking forward to that over time. And I think there's also a lot of appetite for evidence. And so a lot of the early childhood supports, for instance, are intended to be evidence-based in the future. And so that actually means defining what is that evidence, what is best practice for helping people for early intervention. So I will pause there, but thank you very much again for attending and listening.
Thank you so much for that action-packed presentation. There's so much there to discuss. I've got a couple of questions on the iPad, which I'll read up, but I would like to invite anyone to come up to the mic if you'd like to ask an open question. But I might just kick off the Q&A, and we've got about 5 minutes. The National Disability Data Asset, if I can just pause on that for a second, because I think that's going to be an incredible dynamic when it keeps developing and we keep getting data streams coming in. I'd like to connect a couple of dots. So if you think about foundational supports, that program, which will help people who may not get access to the NDIS, the rich data streams that are coming in through the NDDA and the intergenerational report, which does that forward projection around, are we going to be able to afford all of our social supports with a shrinking workforce and a shrinking tax base? My question is, do you foresee the capacity of all this data coming in to give us a better way forward to get more people with disabilities into the workforce? Is that something that you would see as a real possibility?
I'll steal your mic. I'll say yes. Certainly, in principle, the idea of linking together data sets to actually see some of those life course journeys is very, very powerful. And I think sort of we get that currently with the NDIS for people in the scheme, which is sort of saying we can see them and their outcomes early in life, and as they remain in the scheme, we can see how those outcomes change. But there's basically no visibility for the broader population, and as Laura sort of showed, 700,000 people in the NDIS, but we're really talking about over 4 million people in Australia with disability. So actually having a bit of a light on that sort of broader population is pretty important. And certainly being able to connect education and housing and income and welfare and all those sorts of things will be quite exciting, if slow.
For a federation, we're always slow, but we get there eventually in most cases. I've got a question here from Bradley Chandra, I think it is. Can you give some examples, flavour, of what is included in your estimate of the benefits of the NDIS and how you estimate the benefits?
Reports online. It's more caveat than report, at least if you start with at the beginning, it's like 5 pages of limitations. But we're asked to look at the net costs and the net benefits. So net costs is saying, well, if we had not introduced the NDIS and just sort of retained the legacy schemes we had before that, which are generally state schemes under the National Disability Agreement, what would they have cost? And then compare that to the NDIS. And so that net cost was actually still quite big, $15 billion or so. And that actually basically says, as Laura's explained in the chart, a lot more funding for people and specifically those people in the scheme. So that's the cost side. That's the easier side. The benefit side, we went very broad. So we looked at outcomes across those domains that you saw before, so the housing, education, employment, et cetera, et cetera. And we found a lot of null results. Estimation was hard. We did find by far the biggest contributor to those benefits was improvement in subjective well-being. And so that's sort of collected from NDIS outcomes data. Obviously, some people would prefer not to include sort of measures that are quite subjective in economic estimates. On discussion and reflection, we decided to include it. But that's saying that the well-being, subjective well-being, as well as sort of a measure, did actually tend to improve for people as they entered the scheme. And after we controlled for everything else we could see, duration in the scheme seemed to be contributing to that effect. And so that was the type of model that we estimated. It's not going to be the last word on outcomes for people in the scheme. I think sort of the reaction to the report's been mixed. I think people recognise it was done under a very tight timeline and using the data that was available, which didn't include the NDDA. But on the flip side, it actually does say that actually improving outcomes for people with disabilities is not easy. So you can't just give a bucket of money in a plan and expect education and employment and health to magically improve. And so that's one thing it does show is that there's still a lot of work to be done on those sorts of outcomes.
Thank you for that response. The next question is from David Chan. How good do you find the data on the disability journey of Australians? A challenge in the healthcare industry is the fragmented nature of providers, services, funding, etc., which is part of the reason the healthcare journey of Australians can be hard to piece together. I'm curious how you find the data on disability in particular.
Variable, I guess. So typically urban data, it doesn't record disability particularly well, particularly when people present for other reasons. So homelessness is a really good example. There is reasonable admin data of people coming in, but the rate of disability that is flagged in that data is very low. That some of the early pilot NDDA work explored that using a broader source to try and validate the rate of disability. And I can't remember the stat. It might be fivefold estimated underreported. There's also very different definitions of disability. Are we talking about impairment? Are we talking about a diagnosis? Are we talking about whether someone actually needs support versus they don't need support, but they do have a disability? So there are a lot of challenges. The data is not great. Again, the justice sector is another one where it's particularly poorly recorded, I think. The NDDA that we've already talked about is part of the excitement about it, is the ability to combine the data sources and get a more consistent definition of disability and look across different sectors and validate some of those rates. Do you want to add anything?
Yeah, thanks. In healthcare, we often define populations with a condition based on diagnosis and treatment. So number of people with disability sort of often gets defined that way. Disability is the same, except it has the problem that for outside the scheme, there's not a lot of supports. And so if you say how many kids under 9, which is sort of one area for targeted foundational supports, will access them, the answer is we don't know because there's no actual measure out there that collects the rate of disability except from the ESTAC survey, which is pretty thin for kids. So that's a challenge. And that question of then, well, how do you define their level of need and whether your supports have been effective over time becomes even trickier. So I think the hope is the data will improve, but for some types of questions, it's really actually not there at all.
I think we're almost at time. Really quickly, one final question that's come in and then we'll wrap up. From Etienne Chan, with respect to the observed trend of increasing diagnosis of disability, is there an indication of increase of underlying levels of disability separate to better awareness and recognition within the community? Are there any potential drivers identified? You've got 2 minutes.
Yeah. I'll also note that there's someone who's done a PhD in the room on autism rates in Australia, so I come from a place of slight humility. The rate of disability in kids has been the strongest increase, and sort of Laura's chart sort of showed that. A lot of that is around developmental delay and autism in children. There's a lot of evidence that a lot of that is related to diagnostic practices. And so better awareness. There's also been sort of changes to the definition of autism that have sort of rolled out gradually over time that have contributed to it. And now we have what is effectively an economic incentive as well. So if you do have a moderate autism diagnosis, that's automatic entry into the NDIS and access to supports, so the therapies and psychologists and so forth, that may be of benefit. So all of those factors would sort of be in favour of no change in underlying need, but a lot of change in how we recognise and support that. The question of whether there's some residual increase and the factors that contribute to that is a fascinating one, and one that I won't attempt to answer right now.
Thank you. Hugh and Laura, thank you so much for an incredible presentation. I learned an awful lot this morning, so I would really like to thank you. If you can put your hands together for Hugh and Laura, thank you so much. And thank you for attending. Thank you.